This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, signature support from the Mayor President's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Your number, 877-217-5757. Emails go to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with one of our favorite guests, Clarence Page, who's usually with us about once a year. Maybe we should call on him more. He's a fascinating gentleman and one of the few people to win Pulitzer Prizes. And not only win one, but he won two, and one for reporting and one for commentary. So he has been one of the most versatile and venerable reporters about American politics in America for a generation or two. And he became famous with the McLaughlin Group. Our Baton Rougean Jack Germond was with us, and it's hard to believe he's been gone 11 years, but he was with us many times, Clarence, and he said, you know, he had a long career in journalism, and some would say a very successful one, but when he went on the McLaughlin Group, he couldn't go anywhere in the world without people recognizing him.
That's right. The power of television, right?
And I'm sure the same is with you.
Yep, definitely happened. I even get respect from New York taxi drivers. That was a breakthrough.
Yeah, well, Clarence went to The Ohio State University, and in his senior year, the Buckeyes of Woody Hayes won the national championship, and he grew up in Dayton, Ohio, same town that brought us Mike Schmidt, both born in 19... Well, Schmidt actually is 49, you're 47, so only a couple of years apart, but I think Schmidt is probably the greatest living Hall of Famer now that Willie Mays has passed. And for those of us of a certain age, Willie Mays was a big part of our youth, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. I have to make a correction, though. I went to Ohio University, not the Ohio State.
Okay, well,
University.
Then my correction. Okay. U also has produced Mike Schmidt, who led him to the College World Series, but in Athens, Ohio.
There you go.
How far is Athens right. from Columbus?
Oh, about an hour and a half drive.
Okay.
Columbus is dead center, Athens is down in the southeast corner, the oldest land-grant college west of the Alleghenies.
And Athens is known for its journalism school, too, which... has produced
right.
a number of prominent people, including Clarence. But Willie Mays, you were born in 47. He made his major league debut when you were three, actually. And then, of course, for the next 23 years, he was great almost until the end. Until 1973, when he had a bad final season, he was one of the top five players in the game and sometimes the best player in baseball. He was also a guy who... He just was an infectious personality for the game, and there will never be another like number 24.
That's right, and he was a pioneer in an era when the first black wasn't necessarily honored in everybody's house, let's put it that way, right? But he helped to really. I still argue, and I'm getting people to go along with me that the integration of baseball. Was really the breakthrough that led to Brown versus Board and all the other civil rights reforms that we saw in subsequent years. Because sports just gets right to the heart of Americans.
Well, yeah, that was at the same time that Willie Mays led the Giants, the New York Giants, to victory over the Cleveland Indians, 1954. But I would argue also, Clarence, that Mays and Aaron – and Jim Brown and Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell, those people, without them in that time, I don't think we would have had the election of Barack Obama in 2008. It made white Americans familiar with black America to some extent, and it was enough, I think, where blacks could be accepted in high places in our country.
Yeah, and it's, I guess you could call it a culture revolution, really, because it really does get to the heart of where people's sentiments are. We should say that Bear Bryant was led the integration of University of Alabama because he wanted to get a better choice of players And they didn't have any black players at first, and that changed rather quickly once they began to see the benefits of desegregation. So I think the rest of the world, the business world, et cetera, just kind of follows right along behind that with the kind of excitement that sports generate.
Well, when Bear Bryant integrated the Alabama program, a year later Charlie McClendon did the LSU program. It had to be the Bear to do it. And if McClendon, who had some great teams in 69, he lost one game by 3 points to Ole Miss, otherwise would have won the national title. But that same time, LSU had an all-white team, and just a few miles away at Southern University, they had Mel Blount, Harold Carmichael, Future Pro Football Hall of Famers who might have come to LSU. Robert Tank Holmes was on that team. Kenny Ellis, a defensive back who was an All-Pro. If LSU had had them in addition to all the other players it had, I think the Tigers would have been invincible. But that was then, and this is now. And now, fortunately, I think it's a good thing, about 85% of the LSU and Alabama rosters are black.
Yeah, does anybody think twice about that now? Yeah. It's become rather routine. I think there's what's done to break through with people to really adjust their comfort level, shall we say. But sports has certainly done a better job of it just by any other institution I know.
877-217-5757 as we segue to American politics 2 days before the debate in Atlanta between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and 19 weeks from November 5th. How much is race a factor in what's going on in the political realm at the highest level right now?
Well, race is always a factor one way or another, but I think what's unusual this time around is we're seeing a lot of nervousness on the part of the Democrats behind their nominee and our current president, Joe Biden. Because Democrats, as you know, everybody knows, I've always had the majority of black support for a lot of different reasons. But this year, there's been a softness in Joe Biden's support, particularly among young African Americans. And that has been a big headache for the party as they try to find ways to find out what's the reason for it and how do you make up for it. And so we're seeing, Vice President Harris get a lot more attention than she has in the past. And that's just one sign of what's been happening.
Well, our friend James Carville has said if Joe Biden can carry Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and the congressional district that Omaha is located in, he will win the election in the Electoral College 270 to 268 if he can carry all the other places that Hillary Clinton did, and that prescription for victory is not unreasonable. But if that is to happen, Biden will have to have heavy minority support in the big cities in those states, in Omaha, in Philadelphia, in Pittsburgh, in Milwaukee, and Detroit. Can he get the 92% that he got 4 years ago, or is that a lost cause?
Well, I don't necessarily expect him to get as much as he did 4 years ago, because that's kind of typical for an incumbent support to have dropped off a bit. But with Biden, it is essential not just to have people on his side, but to have a big turnout. That is what bothers people about the enthusiasm gap that has shown up in his polling. A lot of people call it panic on the left, and it's too early to panic, but there is a real concern about how things have not moved in the way that Democrats had expected. For one thing, they weren't expecting Donald Trump to be able to get through. How many convictions now? Was it 34?
34.
Thank you. That's the number. Right.
And several more potential convictions.
Yeah. And yet his numbers have actually improved with each conviction. And that is because of the way Joe, mm-hmm. of the way Trump campaigns and his uh, there's more than just a political campaign going on here. There's also a movement, and there's a real, I hate to use the word loosely, but there's sort of an evangelical spirit to the MAGA movement now. And I have to be clear about that, because he also has overwhelmingly large evangelical support, something like 80% or more, mm-hmm. With polls that are taken among evangelicals. And that was a big surprise, certainly to me, among other folks, that the disco Don that I knew in the 70s is now is now the leading candidate for evangelicals.
Yeah, he was a Studio 54 guy, and of course he bragged absolutely. About not getting VD was his own personal Vietnam. By the way, Clarence went. We'll talk more with him after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Clarence Page, who is with us, who is a graduate of Ohio University, not the Ohio State, and a listener sent me a list of some of the prominent people, and there are a few other Pulitzer winners who went to Ohio U, so thank you for informing me, and Clarence Page is a proud graduate of Ohio U in Athens, Ohio, and he has worked continuously. And before we go to the phone lines and talk about what's going on with Trump and Biden, you mentioned Donald Trump and how he has remarkably reinvented himself with evangelicals in particular. Both he and Biden sidestepped Vietnam. They both got doctor's excuses to stay out of that war, but you went. You went as a reporter, but it wasn't like reporters were in danger, and a reporter working for the Armed Forces of the United States of America. Was that experience a seminal moment of your young career?
Oh, yeah, it was a seminal moment. Yeah, it kind of bounces between was it the war experience, or was it the experience as a police reporter in Chicago, where one also at the time took one's life into one's own hands. But I have to say that I never actually saw combat, and I point that out to people, because there are so many folks who didn't see combat, say they did, or who saw it and don't want to talk about it. But it was a very important experience, which nowadays I find myself referring back to more and more, because there's so much of a similarity with the way we have politics happening in the streets once again. And being a pivotal element of the presidential race.
Well, I mentioned you've been around for a while, and Clarence doesn't shy from that. Obviously, that's something to be proud of, the fact that he has practiced his craft at the highest levels for about a half century. But it is remarkable that both of us are younger than either of the nominees of the major parties, and I remember when I was a little kid, Kennedy and Nixon, I mentioned it yesterday, collectively in 1960, they were 90 years old. Now these two guys are collectively are 160. The average age is 80. And that seems to be one of the big talking points about what may happen, whether one of them has real problems tomorrow, Thursday night.
Yeah, that's going to be an important element what appearances that will play into the debate. Folks want to, because the Trump campaign's been making a big deal about Donald Trump's, or excuse me, Joe Biden's acuity and his ability to handle the campaign, to handle the office of the president. Donald Trump himself in recent days has been rolling back his criticism of Biden on that score, to talk about what a great debater Biden is. So trying to change the expectations to where Biden looks like a genius now. And that's the sort of element that is playing out. So people will be watching Biden, the pressure's on Biden now, not to walk too slowly or to appear to be shuffling or to appear to be lost in thought or whatever. But Donald Trump has these same pressures to not to remind people of the fact that he's almost as old as Biden.
Well, and he's capable of a gaffe or two, and of course he, at the very least, exaggerates. I was reading the other day, I told a reporter that he was very proud that Joan Rivers voted for him in 2016. Well, Miss Rivers died in 2014, so if she voted for him, it was an illegal vote. Maybe one of those millions of illegal votes that he talks about, but at any rate, or a miracle. There you go. It is somewhat unfortunate that I think this debate will largely be decided on optics rather than topics. And Trump, if he could behave himself, he might actually do well if he dialed it back. But is he capable of doing that, Clarence?
That's a very, very good question. I remember how his last debate with Biden, he went off the rails about two thirds of the way through, and they got into a shouting match and all. He done a good job of keeping his cool up to that point. Now they're going to have moderators will have switches to be able to kill the mics, so he won't be able to keep talking. He might keep talking anyway, but it won't go out over the air. That's going to be an element to be watched. But appearances are always important in campaigns. I think about the fact that we're talking about the black vote. Joe Biden has not generated the same kind of excitement among black voters that Barack Obama generated. Nobody's really expected him to. But at the same time, you want to see some excitement on that side of the stage. Biden did come through in the State of the Union address and played the expectations game very well. People were expecting him to perhaps be slower than he turned out to be. And he was not only quick insofar as recall, but also in dealing with the heckling from the floor. So that's going to make things interesting to watch. Hope everybody tunes in. They should.
Yeah, and 70 million watched the first debate between the two of them last time. This one is early, though. Technically, neither one is the nominee of his party, but that seems to be a foregone conclusion. So,
yeah, that was at the Biden campaign's request. They wanted to get early so that he would have a chance to get, because Biden has been behind in the polls, and so he wants to get an early shot at improving his position. His position has improved. Well, last week he was only 2 points. Well, he was 2 points ahead of Trump, which was within the margin of error. But they were ready to break out champagne at the.
He's been behind, campaign. And based on what's happened the last two times out, it would seem Biden would have to win by about 5 million votes to win the election. Now it comes down to those states, but Carville is right. When you're only 2 points ahead in Virginia, which Biden is right now, then that means you're probably behind in the states that are considered toss-ups, and that's exactly what's going on. So it's the old rising tide lifts all boats kind of situation. But a listener asked a good point. How long will it take Biden to mention Trump's conviction in New York, and how long will it take Trump to mention Hunter Biden's conviction?
Yeah, well, it took a while for Biden's campaign even to make reference to Trump's legal troubles. I expect, though, now, because Biden himself has spoken about Trump's record being has been the first indicted candidate or convicted felon, actually, to make it this far in the presidential race. I suspect the thing is, I wouldn't expect to do much with Hunter Biden, because that really has the biggest appeal among people who already are Trump supporters. I don't know very many people who are on the edge of their seats wondering about what happens to Hunter Biden. He's not running for office. His father is. So that softens the blow for him somewhat. But the problem with the Hunter Biden case for Joe Biden is that it's a distraction, a major distraction. I mean, when your son is going through this kind of a trial and this kind of public relations and political pressures and all, it has to be a real drag on your spirits, et cetera. So I don't expect Trump to rely too heavily on Hunter Biden, but wouldn't be surprised if the name didn't pop up in the debate at some point.
David in Lafayette asks about Robert Kennedy Jr. He was not invited because he's not on enough ballots, but David would have liked to have seen him. I don't think either candidate really wanted him there, did they?
Oh, no. I think back to was 1980 when it was
John Anderson. Yeah,
Reagan. Remember John Anderson? Yeah, you know, you had he was the third party candidate, the third person right there in the middle of the debate stage, and it was a very appealing Republican back in the day when you had some liberal Republicans. Remember those days? But he was very appealing, and yeah. Pulled quite a few votes, but. A lot of folks think that he didn't help cause.
He hurt Carter, I think, but we'll talk more after this with Clarence Page. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with the remarkable Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize winner for reporting and for commentary. And he's been around for a while, born in June 2nd, 1947, 20 days before Pistol Pete Maravich was born. Legend in these parts, and we've been talking about sports icons. Well, Clarence Page has seen a few of those and also a few political campaigns. And a listener notes, Clarence, that sometimes debates can matter. I do remember when I was in college in 1980 in the final Gallup poll, Jimmy Carter was actually a point ahead of Ronald Reagan. And then there was that debate, and that Reagan won 44 states, and he was dead even with a week to go. What happened, and can something like that ever happen again?
Well, there was a you remember the war? I shouldn't say war. The Iran hostage crisis was going on at the time, and fact that when they got close to releasing the hostages, that put a lot of attention on Reagan and Carter, and there was a strong sense at the time that Reagan was the better guy for dealing with a crisis like that. And there's other arguments about what caused the big shift, but there's a little question that Reagan took advantage of the times as they were going on. Also, Carter himself had weakened his own position with a number of people because he had lost his temper over some issues that he had to deal with, and that knocked him off of his timing as well. So I think that was sort of a bit of drama we haven't seen since then. But we don't always have someone with Ronald Reagan's charismatic appeal in the race.
Yeah, I remember Walter Cronkite setting it up, saying we have a debate between a former peanut farmer and a former motion picture star, and Reagan had great communication abilities, and Carter did not, and it showed, and Reagan came across as the amiable guy that he was, even though his politics were a bit harsher than his personality, some would say far more than a bit, but Carter, remember the gaffe when he said he consulted with his daughter, who was a young girl then, about nuclear proliferation? That was an unfortunate.
She was about 13 or 14 or something.
I'm not even sure she was that old.
Yeah. But it was, let's say Carter had a rough time with that campaign. In contrast to his election there in 76, right before. Right after the Watergate scandal.
Yeah, Gerald Ford. And that was a close one, too.
Yeah, and that was there was a lot of anger at the Republicans because of anger at Nixon, and Carter took advantage of that. He was the fresh new breeze coming in, and he excited a lot of young folks. The last days of the Vietnam War were happening in 75. All of that played into that race. And there was a big rush after that for a legislative reform of our election laws. So you hear a lot of that coming back now as people talk about, once again, changing election laws. Many of the reforms that were happened then have been settled law these days. But
are we headed for a close one, or is there a possibility that one of them will pull away as Reagan did in 1980?
Right now, it's looking like it's going to be close. There's so much polling. I've never before heard the term double haters, but that's what pollsters are now calling people who, when they ask, you know, which do you prefer, they say, I hate both of them. You know, that's been rather intense this time. But that's kept the polling very close.
A listener makes a good observation. Wouldn't John McLaughlin have had fun during the Reagan years? Not the Reagan years, the Trump years, the Trump years.
Oh, yeah. Don't we miss John? I mean, he passed away right before that election, but the campaign was going heavily, and we talked a lot about him. We had Pat Buchanan on as part of the crew then as well, and we were all telling Pat, hey, you know, Pat, when you ran for president, you were just ahead of your time. That's all. Because, you know, people talk about Trump's wall, Mexican wall, for example. Pat Buchanan pushed for a fence.
Yeah,
the Buchanan fence, and you could go right down the line. He had really Pat Buchanan won on the campaign platform that Trump campaigned on.
He did, and he gave Bush a lot of problems. And I remember in 1992, Rush Limbaugh even endorsed Pat Buchanan. And, of course, that was a disaster for George Bush. He only got 37% of the votes. It was a three-way race, but Clinton beat him soundly. That was not a close race, and the polls have shown that the Perot votes would have split evenly, so I don't think Perot cost Bush the election, but that was then. And now Bush is remembered by many as a better president than Reagan. Historians, they credit him with his measured response to the invasion of Kuwait against Saddam Hussein, unlike the actions of his son. And he was bold enough to basically give up his presidency to raise taxes. When he said, no new taxes, well, then he raised taxes and the economy was starting to perk up a bit, but it was too late.
Yep, that's right. I look back historically at how that was one of the early indicators that there was a rising strength of ultra-conservative voters in Republican ranks that we saw later with Trump's victory. That had been building for years, when Pat Buchanan ran, he didn't win the nomination, but he did a lot better around the country than folks had been expecting, and that too was an indication that there was just a right wing vote bubbling up.
Well, and Buchanan has acknowledged that he learned a lot in that 92 campaign from David Duke's races in Louisiana in 1990 for the Senate and 1991 for governor. Duke would have won here if not for the fact that he had been head of the Klan and had worn Nazi uniforms when he was in college. So those are they generally don't play well.
That's right. It was also an extraordinarily a large black turnout against Duke as well, so that hurt him. And you didn't see that kind of a black turnout in regard to Trump, and now you're seeing indicators on the fringes there that Trump is going to do better with black voters than Biden. It's a marginal thing, but that is it's a possibility. I think it's exaggerated. We will see what happens.
As we hit the finish line, I'm looking through some emails, and a listener says, this is in reference to a couple of your recent columns, and Clarence writes about pop culture too, but you've written two columns in the last few days, one about Donald Sutherland, the other about Anthony Fauci. Let's start with Fauci. The headline that was in The Advocate, Fauci's hearing gave us politics at its most paranoid. Fauci took a beating when he went before Congress, didn't he?
Yeah, a beating from the same people who've been beating him up all along, but they're a loud bunch. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and the others, they're a loud bunch. I've been covering Fauci off and on since the days of the AIDS epidemic back in the 80s. And I talked to him several times over the years. I have a lot of respect for the man. I hated to see him become a political football, but that was just what was happening.
And Donald Sutherland, dead at 88, a guy who was the quintessential character actor. And as he said, he was told by somebody he looked like the guy next door, and then somebody else said, "You don't look like you came from anybody's neighborhood." But he was a great actor, and he had a long career.
I love the guy. We were talking about my military experience before. I happened to witness the anti-war show that he and Jane Fonda put on and toured around a few American bases and over around the Pacific Rim, the FTA show for Free the Army, or the alternative word that I can't use on TV or radio, but it was a in any case, he had a strong political side to himself, and was someone who was more accessible than Jane Fonda was. And interestingly enough, though, everybody remembers Jane Fonda and her ridiculous trip over to Hanoi, where she sat on top of a anti-aircraft gun of the sort that was shooting down out planes. She's still trying to live that down. But it was at that time, with a bunch of GIs, especially draftees like me, we were delighted to have somebody from outside come visit us, have a show for us, and really, really cared about us when a lot of Americans weren't.
Well, I read in the New York Times, they were in that movie, Clute, which I think Fonda may have won the Academy Award for, but also...
She did, and he was nominated, I think. Not even nominated. He was always underappreciated by the Oscars.
But the Times wrote that he had a 3-year affair with Jane Fonda. I would suspect that was a somewhat volatile coupling.
at the time, it was Hollywood gold, as they say, because it had a lot of publicity. That was he was with Jane Fonda, that was a big news at the time. But remarkably, few people seem to recall that later on compared to remembering Jane, and her publicity appeal was so tremendous, either positively or negatively.
And she ended up marrying Ted Turner. And I remember back in the day, people were talking about him running for president. And if he had, he is one of those people who might have had the same kind of personal magnetism and appeal that Trump had, but he didn't pull the trigger. But Trump did, and took him a long time, and now he's dominated culture.
I was going to say, I thought so too, but...
We got to roll, Clarence, but thanks, and God bless you. Always a pleasure. Back after the... This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And if you go across the river from Baton Rouge, you'll find one of the fine artistic entities in our world, the West Baton Rouge Parish Museum. And there are some major exhibits that are in the offing, one that is going on right now. And then there will be Evolution of the Revolution, which is the primary reason why we have Jeannie Luckett and Lynn Rossi here. But Jeannie, right now there's one that is nearing the finish line. For those who want to get over to the museum sometime in the next few days, tell us more.
Hey, we're currently in the midst of our 29th year of Blast from the Past summer history camp for children ages 6 to 12. And we're so excited that Lynn flew in from Los Angeles to work with the children in the program. You know, it's not often you get to meet with the living artist to ask about her work and how she created the props. And she has a background in the movie industry, so, and that really shows up in her photographs and the props and the sets that she built. So we did a theme, Lights, Camera, Action, as a play on that, and a play on words with action. So we're talking about the history of motion pictures, but with action, we're taking an opportunity to talk about people throughout history who were brave, that took a stand to make the world a better place. So we're teaching the kids about Rosa Parks and Harriet Tubman and other folks, and then mixing all the elements of a summer camp with lots of interactive activities to go along with it.
Well, Lynn lives in California, and she's involved in Evolution of the Revolution. When does this take place? This is, like most exhibits, it'll be around for a little while.
Yes, it'll be up through August 25th. It's definitely worth a hop across the Mississippi River Bridge to come and see. It's visually stunning, and the message in each piece is really powerful.
Well, the Evolution of the Revolution presents a photographic journey that explores the African-American revolutionary path from the transatlantic Middle Passage to present-day politics, including pivotal moments, the Underground Railroad, and the Civil Rights Movement. It's a multimedia installation, and it is, I'm told, just a magnificent presentation. And bright, large-scale photographs featured in the Evolution of Revolution do more than pay tribute to the men and women who triumphed over slavery and the struggle for equal rights. They provide a poignant commentary on how that revolution still reverberates through contemporary culture. And Lynn Rossi, you're on the front lines of this. I know you're intricately involved. Tell us more about how you became part of this.
Thank you so much. It actually was my idea, my idea and my creative partner, Nichelle Evans. We started this project back in 2009, and we really wanted to create a photo series that addressed key elements of African-American history and contributions to American history that weren't really taught in the classrooms, especially in the wake of the current political climate involving Black Lives Matter and social injustices for the African-American community. So we created this series to help tie past to present and to help teach a lesson for the future to change things.
Well, some of the exhibits, Buffalo Soldier, that's
yes,
certainly captivating. A photograph embodying the fiery revolutionary legacy passed from the Civil War Buffalo Soldier to the Civil Rights Black Panther Street Soldier in their battle in America. And then Amistad.
Yes, Amistad, which talks about the Amistad slave revolt and ties how the Amistad slave revolt had had elements contributing to the modern day from the slave trade to the drug trade because of the lack of economic opportunities as a result of Jim Crow.
And Rosa Parks.
Yeah, one of the most current photos we've done, Rosa Parks and the Revolution Ride, features Rosa Parks and then key characters from the civil rights movement riding on the bus for social justice and change.
And Jeannie Luckett, you never stop over there. I know you have exhibits throughout the year, and it won't stop with the Evolution of the Revolution. I suspect you've got some other stuff in the offing coming soon after that.
We do. We do. Next is a community event commemorating the local Parks and Rec department and all their great things and growth to make, you know, life a better place in West Baton Rouge Parish. And after that, there's a Haitian exhibit, so that's a nice international connection. Next year, we even have a Creole exhibit that our director, our curators, and some other fine folks, lots of outside partners, are working globally to bring something really big. And by the way, that leads to the theme for next year's Summer History Camp. It'll be Creole folktales.
All right, and a listener, this is Howan Monroe, says he wants to come look at it, saying, what are the hours and the precise location for those who have not been?
Oh, sure.
Right off I-10, I know.
Right off I-10. We're located at 845 North Jefferson Avenue in Port Allen. If you know where the community center is, we're right next door. And we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4:30, and Sundays 2 to 5.
Well, very good. Thank you, and good luck with Evolution of the Revolution, an important presentation and exhibit. And Lynn Rossi, thanks for coming this way from the Golden State.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Jeannie Luckett.
Thank you so much.
We're joined now in our remaining moments by James Charles Smith. His book is Flightless Falcon. James is an accomplished novelist, and this book has a gallery of memorable characters reminding us of unresolved complexities of the Vietnam era, which we talked about with Clarence Page. Flightless Falcon is a place in literature that maintains its hold on the American imagination. And good morning to you, James.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us how you became an authority on this time and place.
Well, I lived it, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So basically that was also my, I was 19 in 1969, which is when this novel takes place. And, So it, the overall arc of the story is actually pretty close to what I went through. However, all the characters and events that transpire during the book are acts of fiction for sure.
Your protagonist is Sam Roberts, a fascinating person. I suspect there's a bit of you and perhaps a bit of your father in Sam.
A bit. More me than my father.
Tell us more about Sam.
Well, Sam is basically an Air Force brat. His father really wants him to go to the Air Force Academy, but to humor him, Sam takes all the tests and thinking that his chances of going there are not that great anyway, because it requires a congressional appointment, or the president of the United States to appoint you to go there. But then he wakes up at the academy and his first thought is, how do I get out of this? You know, and it takes him just about a year to get around to the actual idea of resigning from the Air Force Academy.
Well,
and then he hitchhikes back across the United States.
Yeah, a year into his academy experience, Sam resigns. His father is furious. His mother is understanding, but unsupportive. And for him, Sam doesn't know what to think anymore. He knows he doesn't believe in the U.S. involvement in Vietnam and can't be a part of it any longer. And you also dropped out after a year, correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
And what propelled you?
Mostly the same reasons. And I guess an even bigger reason was that the training at the Air Force Academy, and this is not criticizing them, but their job is to make you a very cold and calculating pilot who won't panic when his wing's on fire. But Sam is alarmed by what that is doing to his personality, and he has greater doubts about the military in general.
Well, I remember in 92 when Clinton ran, and Clinton was not technically a draft dodger. He did expose himself to the draft through the lottery, and he got lucky. Mm-hmm. But he was not technically a draft dodger. Now, Trump was a draft dodger, as was Biden, as were several others who served at high levels of the U.S. government. But I know from personal experience in Louisiana, Trump is relatively, and maybe more than relatively, popular with veterans. Has our opinion of that war and why people stayed out changed through the years?
I believe it has. I think there has been a dissension through the various Gulf Wars and everything else, but it does not compare at all to how people felt during the Vietnam War. And it was slow to grow. We got into it with the best of intentions. But as it drug on, around the years of 1968 and 69, the resistance, really did stiffen to the war.
Does it still have repercussions on our psyche in this country? Because we lost that one. We didn't win.
Yes.
The U.S. is accustomed to winning.
Yes. Well, the image of people hanging off the helicopter, the last helicopter leaving Saigon, was an image that was burned into everyone's consciousness. And it was we had tried for years to try to extricate ourselves gracefully and with some at least neutral outcome. And so yes, it did. It was a big blow to us when we left also.
Well, the book is Flightless Falcon from James Charles Smith. The main character is Sam Roberts, who is a lot like James Charles. And it is not only a book about what happened then, but what happened to our country during that time. And thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure. We're back tomorrow. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.